really comfortable with physical illnesses. So you have a cold, you have the flu. I'm understanding of that. Other people are understanding of that. Mental illnesses are very, very different. Society's almost grown up thinking of having fear of them, of having this, we don't talk about things like that. But we've got a long way to come. During my career, both in the police force, but also in the mental health profession, it's really clear to me that the sooner an individual seeks support, the sooner that they find that courage to ask for support, to speak out, the quicker their recovery is going to be.
Is it harder for young people in particular, do you think?
I think young people, they're under a lot of pressure these days. Schools are far more pressurised. The amount of examinations that they do, the expectations. At a point, for some people, they do need professional support. But we can all play a part in being there, in showing the other person that we've got time for them. We're going to listen to what they're saying, that we're going to be non-judgmental and that we care. The biggest message is don't sit at home worrying. Make that call, make that application and get that consultation to put things on the right track for you, your child and your family.
Hello and welcome back to our fourth episode of One Chat, the podcast that highlights the power of conversation and the impact it can have on our health and well-being. As always, we hope it inspires you to stand up and take action to improve your life and those around you. My name is Julie Hughes-Edwards and today I'm having One Chat with Colin Preece. Our guest is a mental health expert who's helped many people get to grips with their health and well-being over time, learning a lot about the human mind along the way. During his time as a police officer, as a clinical psychologist working with Olympians, Paralympians and elite athletes, and with ex-servicemen, through to today, working with families as clinical counselling lead at Teladoc Health UK, Colin knows just how valuable talking to one another can be. Colin, welcome. Thank you very much for joining us today. You and I are today talking fundamentally about the different ways we can manage our well-being and the things we can do, like talking, to improve the mental health of ourselves and people around us. Now, we're hoping you're going to give us an insight into Colin the person, but also Colin the medical professional too. Before we get there, could you just tell us a little bit about yourself, some of your background and some of your expertise?
Okay, of course. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm a psychologist, a chartered psychologist and a psychotherapist, and I'm the head of mental health at Teladoc Health UK. So I oversee a team of counsellors and a team of psychologists. When I left school, I went straight into the police force. So that's how I started. I was a police officer for many years. Left the police force, went into sports psychology, went into education. Fire that, found myself in COVID, starting to really think, how can I make a difference? So we were seeing the impact of COVID on people. And that was almost a call to arms for me to go back into clinical work and to start to see patients. I supported teachers as they were teaching through the pandemic, and then went back into work, working for the charity Help for Heroes before starting my role at Teladoc Health.
What those small insights tell me straight away is you've got a real rich experience of positively helping people with their mental health. You talked about a whole host of roles there. You've gone from the police officer to, in some ways, retraining, and then you're even helping the likes of teachers, etc. I mean, what was the chat that led you to realise you wanted to do a job that helps people with their mental well-being?
I think it's easy now when you look back to make sense of the journey that I've been on. And I do view it as being a journey that's all been led by the constant theme of helping people, this desire to help people, this desire to interact with people and to help them lead the best lives possible. When I reflect back, I had some terrible careers advice, Julie. If I'm truthful, the careers advice person in those days said to me, have you thought about joining the police because you're tall?
That was
the careers advice that I was given, and I ended up drifting into the police force. Liked it, But what did I learn? When I reflect, what did I learn? And I learned and gained the ability to talk to people at all levels, from people that weren't particularly keen to see me because they were going to be arrested, they were going to be put in the cells, to people who were really happy to see me, that they'd called 999 and they were getting people, and everybody in between. And so it was this bedrock of putting in place the ability to be able to communicate with people, the ability to be able to talk to people, to understand what they were saying, to read in between the words that they were saying. And of course, that's really useful in my role now, because it's sometimes a lot more than the words people are saying. So when you have a conversation, you're looking at people. I'm looking in your eyes now, you're looking in my eyes when we're talking, and we're getting a feel for each other. And that's the really important bit with conversations. Really small conversations can have huge differences in people's lives.
It sounds like a lot of what you described there is actually about listening. So it'll be interesting to come back to how that plays a role in the work you do. How do you approach trying to help somebody with their mental well-being? Is it something we can all do as individuals? Or can you give us an idea of how you might typically approach a well-being conversation?
The important point, yes, we can all do it. We can all play a part. At a point, for some people, they do need professional support. But we can all play a part in being there, in showing the other person that we've got time for them, that we're going to listen to what they're saying, that we're going to be non-judgmental, and that we care, that we've got this empathy, this shared humanity. And that's really, really important in any of our conversations. It is about honesty and humanity and empathy.
It's about being human, isn't it?
Exactly that, yeah. Yes.
As someone whose job it is to actually talk to people about their emotional health, do you think it's easy for people to talk about their emotional well-being? It seems like such a simple interaction, doesn't it? You and I are sitting talking on a sofa right now and talking about the idea of mental health, but is it easy to actually do?
You know the answer to that, and I know the answer to that. It's not. It's not. We grow up in a society where mental weakness, mental challenges are thought of as being something that we shouldn't have, that are really weaknesses at an individual level. We're really comfortable with physical illnesses. So you have a cold, you have the flu. I'm understanding of that. Other people are understanding of that and think, oh, Julie's not herself today because she's got a cold. Mental illnesses are very, very different. Society's almost grown up thinking of having fear of them, of having this, we don't talk about things like that. And a lot of that is historical. We're getting better as a society. We're being more open. A lot of the sports people that we're seeing, a lot of our media personalities are helping in that. The Royal Family are helping in that, getting that messaging out. So it's really, really positive, but we've got a long way to come. And during my career, both in the police force, but also in the mental health profession, it's really clear to me that the sooner an individual seeks support, the sooner that they find that courage to ask for support, to speak out, the quicker their recovery is going to be, the quicker they're going to get the support that they need and end up in the place that they want to be and lead fulfilling lives.
Thinking about your career, though, you started by telling us about being in the police force, police officer, and you learned from that that there were ways in which you could help, just having that conversation or somebody being pleased to see you. What were the chats that you've had in your career with the police that influenced your own well-being? Or do you recall any yourself where you speaking to them actually made a real difference?
I'm going to talk about a case probably 25 years ago. And this was a lady that had been arrested and brought into the police station. So she'd been detained under the Mental Health Act. And she was with me during the course of a night. So it was nights. And there was fear for her safety. So she was going to be kept under constant supervision. And she actually sat in the custody area and spoke to me in the course of the in the course of the night, and we had really in-depth conversations about her life and about how she felt lonely and unsupported, and how she felt very, very desperate and alone. And we spoke for hours during that evening. And it was really meaningful conversation. And when the shifts changed in the morning, she thanked me for that conversation, for speaking to her. She went off to hospital and so forth. About a month later, I was informed that she'd actually died by suicide.
Oh.
And that was a key moment when I thought, I can make a difference in this mental health world. I can begin to develop my own skills to make a difference. So I enrolled on an Open University course, and that was the start of my educational journey. When I began to train as a chartered psychologist, first of all part-time by remote learning, and I was doing academic study in the back of riot vans at times on nights, and writing up assignments because it was handwritten in those days. But I link it all back to that conversation that I had with that lady that was a dreadfully sad result of the conversation, a dreadfully sad thing, but a really significant thing in my life that's led me to where I am today. And so I think about it. I think about it often, and I think about that lady often. And if I can make any small changes to other people's lives to help them in any small way, that's a positive thing for me.
Yeah, I can imagine anybody who's in that situation, that sense of I'm alone with this, the most important thing is they just reach out and talk to someone, isn't it? Because no one should feel that desperate and that they can't go on.
No, and it is, and that's what I implore. That's the message that I send out. Reach out, ask for support, speak about how you're feeling, and speak openly about how you're feeling.
A 30-year career with the police, is that right?
26, 27.
It's a long time, yeah. Isn't it, to do one job?
Yeah.
I mean, but that's just the start of your journey. As you said, that moment there, that chat changed your life. And it made you realise you wanted to do more to help people. And then you've had a wide range of jobs around this. I mean, I'm fascinated by the career you've had. You know, you've really embraced this. I want to help people and I want to make the most of my skills and this idea of talking to people along the way. You talked about the work you did with teachers as well, but tell us about one of these areas that I found fascinating. Tell us about the work you've done where you've worked with Olympians and Paralympians. How did you end up doing that?
It's really quite an interesting story and a tale of serendipity where things just happen. Always been quite keen in shooting, so in target shooting, and through the target shooting world, I worked with British Shooting, and as a result of that, then became involved with British Swimming. And through that, people get to know you and can have that ability to contact you. And was contacted by professional football players, so some professional football players and also some people that swim in Olympic competitions and so forth. Well, what's my big learning from it? My big learning from it is that these top athletes, these top stars, are human. They're the same as you and me. They're incredibly good at football, at shooting, at swimming. But fundamentally, they're humans. And they have these flaws and these feelings of inadequacy at times, these feelings of nerves, that you and I may share. And so any psychological work with them is just exactly the same as working with anybody else. They're highly motivated. So if you tell them to go away and practice something, you know, for half an hour a day, they'll probably do 3 hours. So they're incredibly motivated in that sense. But fundamentally, they're like you and me, and they've got those same traits and same fears that we all have.
I mean, you've touched on exactly what I thought might be the case. You know, over the years, I've had a chance to listen to elite sports stars talking about their experience of training and the dedication it takes to do their job. You know, they require a huge amount of mental well-being and resilience and determination to do that training to get to that peak performance. What sort of conversations are you having with elite athletes, whatever their background, to manage themselves? Because I anticipated their need would be different, and you're saying they're very much like us.
Yeah, very much like us. So, you know, the same as you, if you or I undertake a fitness campaign, we might need work on motivation. We work on motivation with them. We work on visualization. They may be visualizing winning an Olympic gold medal. You may be visualizing, you know, achieving going to the gym every day for 2 weeks. It's the same processes, just on a different level. We work on things. So, for example, in competitions, we will visualize them walking out to the side of the swimming pool, ready in a competitive race, sensing, hearing the crowd, feeling that sensation of pressure, accepting that, understanding that on a psychological level, so that then when the real competition comes, they're ready for it, they're expecting it, and they don't become overwhelmed with those senses of pressure, and they can regulate their heart rate, regulate their breathing, and ultimately give their best performance possible. So it's really about control, allowing them to control as much of that competitive environment as absolutely possible, so that all the hard work they've put into their training, they can put into the competition.
It never occurred to me, to be honest, that actually what you're talking about here is you're even preparing your mind mentally for what's ahead of you. I don't think we do that particularly well, do you? You know, we go into things in life where we just kind of think we're doing it, whereas actually you can visualize the situation you're going into, and actually that can help you prepare. Can you give us an example? You talked about walking out into a swimming pool and the crowd, etc. Can you give us another example of the ways you're able to help an athlete with their well-being and how they can actually prepare for those difficult situations that they know they're going to struggle with?
A really good example is, and this, you can see the similarities between us all, is when they're having an operation. So athletes, by the nature of the physical pressures that they put on their body, are prone to injuries. And often have to have operations, the same as you or I could have to have an operation. And we will use visualization, we will use relaxation techniques to get them ready for that, both the operation, but also that recovery period afterwards. You know, I've got a friend currently who's had a knee operation, and the recovery phase of it, I don't think she was prepared for at all. And, you know, we've had some discussions around patience and around acceptance that it will take time in order to recover. And that's where we work with these athletes. Obviously, for them, that recovery period is really important. Many of them will only have very, very short careers. And so any time when they're not competing is time away from doing their job. And so they do get impatient by nature. But with visualization, with a sense of perspective, with a sense of refocusing, we're able to control the situation as best as possible so that they can be ready psychologically to begin training when they're physically ready.
You're talking about elite athletes preparing for operations, but actually what you flag is we probably don't prepare ourselves well enough for a situation where, as you say, you can go through an operation, but you don't necessarily prepare for the recovery of that. We all go through situations where we can end up ill or needing to take a bit of time out to recover from an illness. Can you give some guidance on what we can do to manage that? Because I know from my own experience, you know, I a couple of years ago had an operation, and you do with a doctor or a consultant, you prepare for the bit where they do their stage. It's the after effect, isn't it? Where you haven't thought about how long you might be unable to move around. Or so what can you recommend? How should we use that experience?
I think it's in so many aspects of life. It's about advanced planning. It's about thinking of options and putting these options in place. It's about getting support in place within their family to support them as they are recovering, to assist with simple things like shopping and lifting and things like that. It's about communication, as we're talking about communication. It's about communication. It's about talking to, for instance, relatives, children, and explaining to them the procedure that's going to be happening and about the recovery and how things will change for a period of time. And it is about this acceptance that there is going to be this convalescence period, and really important to reach out and for support and help at the earliest possible stage. If you feel that you are struggling, don't bottle things up. You know, the constant message that we're having today is if you've got access to support, reach out and ask for help. Ask for it at that early stage, because intervention at that early stage increases your chances of a speedy recovery.
I don't think we appreciate really when you have a physical challenge, how important your mental well-being is within that, or at least being mentally able to cope with it, do we? That is such an important part of any recovery.
They're really interwoven. So, you know, the psychological side of injury, the psychological side of illness is really significant. And as soon as pain is tiring, battling and fighting pain is tiring, changes to our routine cause us to have stress, and this all impacts on our mental health and can pull us down. It can have impact on our sleeping. As soon as we begin to have struggles sleeping, that makes us more susceptible to psychological challenges. And so it really is this whole person care that we need to look after. So we need to balance the physical side with the psychological, mental side.
Now, just thinking about the physical side, there might be people in our audience who are thinking about doing a great physical challenge of their own. It could be they want to do a charity hike. It might be they're trying to do a half marathon, or goodness, I couldn't contemplate it, but a marathon, you know. Mm. That takes an immense amount of preparation to achieve that in the first place. What advice have you got for anyone who's thinking of doing that in terms of the mental preparation that they might need to consider?
I think small steps, set yourself realistic goals. Don't set challenges that you can't achieve straight away. Set small goals. Incorporate these things into daily routines. Reward yourself. So reward yourself. Maybe keep a journal. Maybe keep a record on the wall where you mark your achievements. Post it on social media. Tell your friends how you're getting on. Encourage that contact around you, and maybe get your friends engaged in that challenge as well. So there's a social aspect to it. There are so many ways that you can engage in a really positive way. You know, and I'm a big fan of the outdoors. So I'm a real big fan of the outdoors. So if you've got training that you can do outdoors, get outside, get into nature, and while you're training, while you're doing the task, enjoy that wonderful sense of being outside, that sense of nature, because that will make you feel better. And by feeling better, you'll be encouraged and motivated to do even more.
You've talked about the work you've done with the police force and how you then changed careers effectively. Mm. And you came to do work with a whole range of people, athletes, etc. One of the things I found fascinating about your career is you've then done some work with Help for Heroes. Now, tell us a little bit about that. How do you get into working with ex-servicemen who, let's be realistic, they will have had some interesting challenges of their own across their own careers? What sort of work are you doing with Help for Heroes, and what type of support are they needing? It must be quite varied.
It is quite varied because, of course, you've got some people that have, from often early ages, often from leaving school, have invested their life in the armed forces. Many have been injured or have had their career cut short by injury, which can be physical, can be psychological, can be both. And in that process, they've looked, in many ways, lost their identity. It was their role to join the armed forces to protect us, to protect the country. And I met some incredible people. I met some incredible people whilst I was supporting Help for Heroes. But the links to me were really close with the police service, and in conversations again, the veterans were showing the similarities. They were talking of the similarities. And actually, many veterans, when they leave the military, will go and join the police service or those uniformed forces. And so, yeah, the links were there. And we dealt with all sorts of things, from challenges over identity to people that had suffered really traumatic events and were suffering from PTSD, to people who were suffering with moral injury and challenges around that. But of course, I come back to that point that our veterans, the people who have served in the armed forces, are like you and me. They're people, and so they'll be prone to all of these psychological challenges that we all are. Just on occasions that, you know, they have experienced far more traumatic events than, thankfully, we will ever have to experience.
How much of the work you were doing with Help for Heroes was about guiding them on the mental health? How much of it was about listening?
I don't think you can look at them individually. I think they're combined. Mm. You know, I think they're combined. In listening, you're helping and you're supporting. You're making that person feel valued. You're making them feel that they're important to you. And in doing so, you form that connection, that relationship. In a work sense, for me, it's a therapeutic relationship. But when we talk outside of the therapy sessions, it's a relationship. And relationships are really important to us as people. And so, yeah, listening is really important. As we're often told, we've got one mouth and two ears. And so we should listen a lot more than we talk. But listening to the intonation, listening to the words, and observing and watching those reactions as you do have a conversation are really, really important.
I'm curious, is it harder for young people in particular, do you think, to make that move to ask for help? Is there a difference in our ability as we get older? Is it easier at that point, do you think?
I think it's challenging for us all. I think young people, they're under a lot of pressure these days. Schools are far more pressurised than certainly when I was there. The amount of examinations that they do, the expectations, the impact of social media, all of these factors impact. We're still seeing the afterwaves of the lockdown and the pandemic. And to me, for instance, that period of lockdown was a relatively short time in the course of my life. However, for younger people, it was a significant percentage of their time in terms of socialising, in terms of going to school, in terms of engaging with friends and things outside. And so we are seeing the impact of that in younger people. And I think that the challenges for young people are exactly the same, but they maybe don't have the confidence of someone who's older, who thinks, yeah, I need help. So they keep things to themselves. They keep this acceptance that this is going to pass, that this will get better by itself. And often that's not the case. They need to reach out. They need to get support. And just like adults, the sooner they get that support, the quicker they can be redirected. I use the analogy of a ship leaving a harbour. When a ship leaves a harbour, a few degrees in the course that they take can lead them to a completely different destination. And those few degrees, if they happen early on in that journey, can lead them, you know, to a really positive place. Whereas if there hadn't been any intervention, they may drift into a darker place, and it becomes more challenging to correct them. So it really is important that they do reach out, or that parents encourage them to reach out. Parents reach out on their behalf to get that support. But yeah, we have to accept we live in a world now that our young people do have pressures put on them that were not there in the past, and we as a society have to support them in any way that we can.
I wonder if this is where your work as clinical counselling lead or head of mental health at the telehealth service Teladoc UK comes in, or Teladoc Health UK, I should say. The work you're doing there as a head of mental health of a team is very much working with families, isn't it? You know, it's not just there for adults who can come and ask for help. It's there for children too and young people. Now, this is part of an integrated wellbeing service. So it's a service I know well because it's a service that my company as an insurer offers to people, and they can come and get help with any aspect of their well-being. It could be they need a bit of help from a GP, but actually mental health counselling is one of the important handovers that a GP can provide if somebody thinks that's a good idea. How does it work in using a telehealth service like the one you lead on the mental health support? How does somebody come and get help? And then can you give us an idea of how you can actually use that service to help a family or the young person that needs the support?
If a young person within a family is ill, if they're struggling, then it impacts on that whole family. I hear many parents say, I wish it was me that was suffering rather than my child. The impact is so great, and so yeah, it's a really impactful offering that we have that supports the young person, but most notably the whole family, because it does impact on that whole family. And when a young person's ill, the parents are not keen to go to work. They really struggle to go to work, and sometimes they're not doing their best work because they're worrying about the child. So how does it work? Well, what we do is we ask the parent to contact us. So the parent will contact us. The parent will have an appointment either with myself or one of our senior clinicians. And we will take details and listen to the parent to find out exactly what's impacting on that young person, how it's affecting their life, and how it's affecting the whole family. So it's all done remotely. This has great benefits because it means that the family don't have to travel. People don't have to take time off school. They don't have to take time off work to do it, and they can schedule it at a time to suit them. The child's young person is in their own house, so they haven't got the stress of going to a medical appointment at a hospital or at a venue that they don't know. And it's really efficient. We're finding that during COVID, the whole psyche of the country has changed in terms of appointments, and we're finding that the world has embraced video calls, video consultations. My clinicians have gained a huge amount of experience in conducting these, and through doing that, we're really seeing that daily the impact, the positive impact that it's having on young people and their families.
So someone's taken that step of coming to get help from an expert. Can you give us a flavour of what a counselling session might be like, or what that might feel like to the individual in it? How you as a person will help guide them through that consultation?
Of course. They will have had the appointment made at a time to suit them in the course of their day. And what we would do as a service, we would want that person to be in a quiet, confidential space, preferably, you know, somewhere at home where they're not going to be disturbed. And just to be ready to have a conversation, just to be ready to have a chat. A chat with a friend who they're meeting for the first time, but a friend who's going to be understanding, who's going to be empathetic, who's going to be keen to find out what's happening for them and what challenges they're experiencing. So as relaxed as possible is the best way to be, not fearful. And ready to engage, ready to be honest, and ready to share thoughts, feelings, and emotions. Most people are slightly apprehensive before the first session. Of course they are. But what do we find? We find that after that first session, after those first few minutes of that first session, this nervousness, this anxiety dissipates, and the professional nature of the clinicians that work for us takes over, and the patient finds it really beneficial, really engaged, and the opportunity to discuss their personal thoughts, fears, concerns in a confidential space, one that's full of support and empathy. And so, yeah, don't be fearful, apply for that support, and just engage with the process. Throw yourself fully into it and engage with that process.
Our audience might be listening and thinking, this is very interesting, but actually I don't need maybe the help of a counsellor or a psychologist. Maybe they just want to think about the way they manage their well-being day to day. What advice have you got for individuals who perhaps feel they just want to make some improvements to their mental well-being that they can use on a day-to-day basis?
Okay, on a day-to-day basis, I think it's about getting the fundamentals in place. So good sleep. You know, there's lots of resources about where you can get some very good information on sleep, but the basics, get a good routine, good sleep hygiene. Try to go to bed at the same time each day, get up at the same time, and, you know, not use mobile devices before bedtime, all of those sort of things that we know but sometimes we choose to ignore. So get that in place, a decent sleep routine, good nutrition. So get your eating right, eat as healthy as possible, and try to get that good routine in place. And also exercise. Exercise is really important for us at that fundamental well-being level. It doesn't mean that we all have to be Olympic athletes and have huge training plans, but try to get some exercise in place, even if it is going for, you know, a moderate walk. Concentrate on those sensations, the breeze on your face, the fresh air as you breathe in, take those deep breaths when you're outside, and really get those fundamentals in place and try to do it, you know, on a daily basis, on a weekly basis. Get those things in place and see how that that makes you feel. And maybe engage those activities. Go for a walk with a friend. Go for a walk with several friends and get that engagement in. And while you're walking, have a chat. Talk about your problems. Talk about the things that have happened for you that day, whether they're good, bad, or indifferent. It just normalizes things. It just normalizes things. And listen to your friends. Listen to them sharing what's happened to them in the day. And that helps to keep things in context. That helps to really reframe any individual problems that we may have and think, oh, it's not just me. That's going on for everybody in the world. And in doing that, that makes us feel better.
The challenge is that we live such busy lives. You know, I can speak to my own experience. You know, I'm busy running around. I've got a job to do. I've got the children to look after. There's, you know, running a house is a challenge. We don't actually stop and think about our mental well-being enough, do we? You know, so when you need that help, it's a really big step to go out and ask for the help. If somebody is in that position where they need the help at this point, where they've got to take that brave step forward and ask for it, what would you recommend they do? Because it is such a big moment when you need to get the help from someone.
I think they need to just do it. They need to take that first step and just do it. It can seem a ginormous step. It can seem a ginormous challenge. But once people have done it, the feedback that we're consistently getting is, I wish I'd have done this years ago. I wish I'd have done this some time ago. My team are really practiced in talking to people. My team are really practiced in understanding the challenges and the reluctance to come forward and to reach out for support. And historically, I think I as a parent would have hesitated. You know, going back to, I would have still been in the police force in those times. I would have hesitated and thought, is this the thing to do? Is it serious enough to reach out for support? And I think that's the concern of many people. They're there thinking, is this serious enough for me to make contact, to seek advice? My advice on that is, yes, reach out, make contact, make support. The sooner that we can speak to a medical professional, the sooner that you can get that intervention, the quicker that we can resolve things. And often things resolved at this really early stage can be sorted so rapidly and quickly. And in many, many cases, just as a result of one or two contacts with our clinicians, it'll be resolved. And you'll get that reassurance, you'll get that support, you'll get that comfort in knowing that you've done the best for your child. And that in doing so, you've put them on the right track. You've pointed them in that right direction. And of course, our service is there constantly. So if they need to come back, then they can do that. And people do that over a course of a period of time. But the biggest message is don't sit at home worrying. Make that call. Make that application. And get that consultation to put things on the right track for you, your child and your family.
So take that first step.
take that first step.
And I should stress as well, obviously, that there are many different services out there now that employers are providing their own employees access to. It might not necessarily be the Teladoc service. There's lots of great mental well-being services that you can get through your phone. It could just be an app that teaches you how to do things for yourself, self-help, rather than having some of the expert advice that, your team are providing.
Exactly that. You go on to an app store associated with your phone, your electronic device. There's lots of things there that are really beneficial. I'm a real fan of relaxation techniques, breathing techniques that you'll find. So you go on the app store, put in breathing techniques, put in relaxation. Lots of apps on there that can be beneficial for you or your child. Do them together. And they can be really, really effective.
You've had a career that has been very much about stopping and talking to people every single day, which I find fascinating. It's actually, you're proactively going and talking to people to try and make a difference. And I don't think we all appreciate we do that sometimes. We just talk to people and we think that's what we're doing. Can you sum up through the work you've done and the conversations you had away, what you think you've learned about people and how we interact day to day?
I'm very positive. So through the course of my journey so far, I'm positive about people. I'm positive about humanity. I love travel. And when I travel, I speak to as many people as I possibly can when I go on holiday from different countries. And so I think it's a universal trait across all people that we want to belong, that we generally want to help, that we don't prosper, we don't feel fully satisfied living in isolation. And we want contact with others. And so I actively, every single day, reach out to other people to engage with them, to support them, and encourage others to do so. And we know in this country, loneliness is a problem. Loneliness is an issue. And so the more people that we can speak to, the more people we can say hello to, good morning to, just in the course of a day, that's positive. That's positive. And then if we can go one step further and start these more meaningful conversations, it can really benefit them and it can really benefit us. It can only seem small chat. It can only seem small conversations. But I'm convinced by the experience of my life that small conversations, small chat can have big outcomes for people. And so, you know, it's important that we all seek these opportunities to engage with each other and to engage, to try to live the best lives that we possibly can.
The work you do, I think, is incredible. You know, you've made an active choice to help people's mental well-being. But yet that's your work. You do a lot more, don't you, that you choose to do for fun. That's also about constantly engaging with people and just sharing experiences. Just because I would love people to understand a little bit more about you as a person, not the professional. Tell us about some of the interesting things you do traveling the world, where you're talking about your own knowledge. I mean, you're dressed very dapper today, I have to say. Yeah, and I think it reflects a little bit of your personal interest, doesn't it?
I know where you're leading me now.
Yes.
Yeah, I retired. I retired from the police force, and threw myself into a hobby. I began to write thoughts about when I'd been in the police force down to journal down, and one of the questions came into my head: what made you join the police force? I've shared the careers advice I was given, but of course I didn't resist that careers advice that much, and I began to think, why didn't I? And it led me back my parents, particularly my mother, was really keen that I was going to be an avid reader. So she was a big reader herself, and one of my earliest childhood memories was being taken in the village I lived to the mobile library that came to visit once a week. And I remember one day coming home with a book, and it was a book on Sherlock Holmes. Now, Sherlock Holmes in this book wasn't Sherlock Holmes as we know him. It wasn't Benedict Cumberbatch or Robert Downey Jr. It was a panda Sherlock Holmes. But it was that start of that love of crime, of detection. And I think it was that led me into the police force, this desire to solve puzzles and to do the right thing, I think, to see good winning. When I left the police force, I instantly went on holiday. When I was on holiday, read the whole works of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle.
So the whole lot?
Yeah, the whole lot. So read the whole lot of the collection of Sherlock Holmes stories, and through that saw the clear links about how Conan Doyle had educated this country and the police force in this country through writing about forensics in his work. He'd written about detection work, he'd written about forensics, he'd written about deduction. And in doing so, it helped to train the police force. And so using that knowledge that I'd got about Conan Doyle, but also about British policing, I started to give lectures and go around talking about how Sir Arthur Conan Doyle and Sherlock Holmes had shaped British policing. The sad thing is more people came to see those talks than have ever been to any of my psychology ones. But it was a really fascinating topic, and it's an area that I'm really interested in to these days. But of course it links in when we're talking to patients in our work now. We're looking to understand not only the words that they're saying and listen to the words, but we're looking to piece pictures about their life together and maybe things that they're not saying to understand the complexities of their presentation so that we can support them better. So it all links in. You can view it in isolation, but it all links in. But yeah, I went all over the world from South America through to Russia and to China talking about Sir Arthur Conan Doyle and Sherlock Holmes.
It's such a fascinating experience you've had. I mean, we've been lucky enough to have a conversation about that before all of this, but I found it incredible that you've taken so many aspects of experience and moved from one to another to try and help people with their experiences and just share experience that you've learned. I want to wrap us up, unfortunately, because I could happily talk much more about some of the things you've learned. But I guess, given that these are all shared experiences at this point in life, there's potentially always those that you haven't had yet. You know, it's that dinner party question as well. If you could have that one chat with someone you've never been able to talk to, who would it be? What would you talk about?
Well, I've really enjoyed that. It's a challenging question because I've really enjoyed our conversation today. At one level, I'd like to go back to myself at an earlier time and say to myself, don't worry, Colin, it will all turn out. Don't overthink the small things. Enjoy life and seize opportunities. So there's part of me that would like that. But I think on another level, I'd like to show that I'm perhaps trendy and younger. I'd like to speak to Taylor Swift. So I'd like to speak to Taylor Swift, and I'd like to talk to her about the inspiration that she gets for the lyrics of her songs, because I think her songs are, at many levels, have got a psychological basis to them, and she's playing a part in educating and helping the young people. So yeah, that's the wildness. I'd like to speak to Taylor Swift.
Who knows? Maybe you'll get that chance.
Well, sort it out for me, please.
I'm not sure I can, but maybe if somebody's listening, maybe they can put you in touch.
Thank you.
Colin, thank you so much for sharing all of your experiences today. I genuinely find the path you've taken and the direction you chose to go inspiring, because you have taken your experience to try and help other people. And I really hope anybody who's been listening in the audience or watching will take some of that and use it either to help themselves or help a loved one with their own well-being. We can all, I think, at times learn from somebody else how to just improve our health that little bit more. I'm going to need to have another listen to this to pick up some more tips. I would never have thought of visualization, for example, as something I should be doing more. Maybe I should. That would probably help me. So thank you for your time today. I really appreciate it. I hope the audience has found it valuable too.
Wonderful. Thank you very much. And thank you for giving me the chance to talk about me, but most importantly, the wonderful team that I've got and the wonderful work we do. Thank you.
No, thank you, because I know they really are an amazing team. Thank you so much. My name's Julie Hughes-Edwards, and you've been listening to One Chat.